Hey, everyone, welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. Happy holidays to everybody. This is going to be our final episode before the holidays. We'll be back with another season. I don't know if we're calling it a season, but we'll be back with some fresh episodes after the holiday. This one is a really special one for us. As you can see on the screen, I'm joined by my regular cast of characters, Matt Kachansky, retired senior leader from OIG and the former director of the UPIC Northeast, Jason Eisengrein, another retired leader from the OIG and also retired from the UPIC West, Wade McFowl, retired assistant special agent in charge from our LA office. I am the director of litigation, fraud, waste, and abuse. I am also a retired OIG agent out of New York. And today we've got a really special guest. For those of you that have worked in the healthcare fraud, waste, and abuse world for anything longer than 1 minute, you will know Gene Stone. Gene Stone spent over 46 years at CMS back in the day when it wasn't known as CMS, back in the day when it wasn't even known as HCFA, when it was HEW, Health, Education, and Welfare. Gene has been a staple in the OIG, CMS, fraud, waste, abuse, and compliance community. I am proud to call her a friend. I have known her for a very long time. I often say that I've had two mentors in my career. One was Jason, who taught me everything that I needed to know about being an OIG agent and an investigator, and Gene, who taught me everything I needed to know about dealing with CMS and things like LCDs, NCDs, and the like. And so I'm super excited to have Gene here. We're going to do a lot of talking about fraud, waste, abuse, compliance. We're going to talk about her career at CMS. We're going to talk about what she's doing now and maybe throw in a couple of nuggets about some of her post-career work. So, Gene, we're super happy to have you here. This has been in the works for a while, and just with scheduling, it's been a little bit of a challenge. And I just want to jump right into it. You spent 46-plus years in the fight against fraud, waste, and abuse, and interacting with the OIG and OIG partnerships, U.S. attorneys' offices, and the like. Let's spend a couple of minutes just really talking about sort of that evolution that CMS has had over the years from, you know, kind of when you started, where program integrity wasn't really a thing, all the way through to today. So you came to CMS back when it wasn't CMS, but we'll call it CMS. Back in the early 70s, and tell us a little bit, like, you know, walk us through a little bit of that history that you, where you started and, you know, kind of where you ended up.
Having been born and raised in D.C., I started working for Health, Education, and Welfare when I graduated from college, and I worked in international healthcare. It was the excess foreign currency countries when the U.S. would sell wheat to Russia, Iran, Israel, Yugoslavia, back when we had Yugoslavia. They would buy our wheat. We had to spend the money in that country. So we did international rehabilitation research, and we partnered with Baylor University, a number of U.S. hospitals who did rehabilitation. A lot of it was cardiac. The Belgrade Hand in Yugoslavia, where it was one of the first where they attached the neurostimulators to muscles so it could actually operate an artificial hand. It was the most exciting thing. I moved to New York in 75, started working in the regional office in Medicaid, in early and periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment. And it was where we would go to six of the counties in New York, six in New Jersey, every quarter, and we had to go to Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands to review their healthcare centers to make sure that they were offering screening to mothers who were or fathers who were applying for Medicaid, and if they opted to have the diagnosis and testing, if any problems were found, then the county had to initiate treatment within 60 days. So we were following up on them. We were checking on the checkers. I then did a lot of special studies where we'd go to hospitals, providers, looking at dialysis centers, actually questioning. We're paying a monthly rate. How often do the dialysis patients actually see a physician? And it was unpopular when our findings came out. And it was a really interesting experience having to go to local medical societies to explain our findings because they were getting a monthly capitation. And they come into the centers, get their dialysis services. But it was like, how much of it was actually a physician interaction with the patients, with them checking their status and things? So as I was doing this, I was getting a broader and broader sense of what the programs were in HHS. But it was also, you're seeing the loopholes. And so it's like, what can we do? It's a great program. What can we do to, you know, plug the loopholes, fix it, make it more efficient, remove the potentially fraudulent types of providers, and how to strengthen, you know, getting in the door to be a provider in the first place. So strengthening provider enrollment processes. Some states themselves had really good processes in place. In New York, the health department has a lot of things in place for clinics and, you know, Article 28 facilities and those kinds of things. But individual physicians, you know, they kind of leave that up to the state licensing and education departments, and then the medical and specialty societies in the counties and in the states. And so there are loopholes. Then when you get into things like DME suppliers, where the individuals who are running the companies are not licensed healthcare professionals and don't need to be, they're businesses. And so, you know, there was an evolution of trying to track and identify who's actually billing the program, tracking then, you know, the license or certification or whatever. And then it was like, okay, now they're in, what are they billing? How are they billing? How do they compare to their peers? And so there was an evolution also of data analysis. And what are the data points to actually track? And then once you find that they are recalcitrant, potentially fraudulent, how do we deal with them? How do you educate them? Because we always had in the CMS side of the house, you educate first. That's when we started coming up with policies like local coverage determinations, that then were there as we consolidated contractors, we consolidated the policies across the states and across regions so that we had much more. And, you know, that's another thing that's kind of evolved also is that the variations by geographic area, they used to have, you know, there was lots of arguments that, well, we do treatment of patients in rural West Virginia or Kentucky very differently than we do in Manhattan, which is true to a point. But then it's like, you've got this diagnosis. These are the appropriate diagnostic tests. It doesn't matter where that diagnostic test is administered. If you have these symptoms, you know, you need to have these tests to confirm or identify what patient's condition is to know what then the appropriate treatment would be. So it took me back to EPSDT and the early and periodic screening. It's like kids get diagnosed, you know, they get the testing. It's like, well, okay, they've got the tests. Now what do the tests, what are the medical conditions that then might need treatment? Same thing for seniors, doesn't matter age. It doesn't, you know, for a middle-aged person in Medicaid, same kind of situation. You test them, what do you do with the test results? If you're just testing and not treating, test results are useless. Bring us up to present day and COVID testing. You know, we're getting warnings coming out now in our senior Medicare patrol. And I volunteer now for New York senior Medicare patrol. After I retired from the federal government, I now volunteer in New York in the senior Medicare patrol. And we educate patients, beneficiaries, their family members, and their caregivers on Medicare and what the benefits are and how it can be scammed. We tell them what the latest scams are. Sometimes they tell us what the latest scams are. So to go back to COVID testing, we're hearing that from people in the field that seniors are getting marketed expired COVID tests, and they've got fake tests, and they've got fake FDA letters confirming that they are in fact valid tests. So if you want to follow up, you know, they say, oh yeah, you can call this number, or you can, you know, text here and get, you know, how valid this test is. And then they get in return this fake FDA letter. So, you know, they're getting sophisticated. They have been sophisticated, but some of the basics, you know, pop up, set up a tent and a table, you know, card table on the street, and you've got your fake COVID tests. And in order to get the test so that it can, even though it's free to the patient, you have to give your Medicare number or your Medicaid number or your insurance number.
And I do want to spend a little bit of time a little bit later talking more about S&P and its role in fraud, waste, and abuse and its interaction, because we've all interacted with S&P in our careers at OIG and Matt and Jason a little bit more even at the UPIC. But so let's, you know, for a few minutes, I do want to talk about this one thing that is kind of important, at least to me, is that from probably the time when I was hired, which was 1997, up until my retirement in January of 2019, you interacted in one way or another with absolutely every single person that was hired as an OIG agent, because you were one of the people that were brought in to teach at the Special Agent Basic Training Program for the OIG. Now, for people that don't know this, when agents get hired at the OIG, they go to the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in Brunswick, Georgia. It's about an hour outside of Jacksonville, Florida. Agents go for their basic agent training, which lasts about 3 or 3.5 months. But that is just general law enforcement training. The class can contain anybody who's in the federal law enforcement job series for special agent. And then when you leave, you go and you get your specialized training from your agency. HHS OIG runs a training program known as the Special Agent Basic Training Program, and it goes about 5 or 6 weeks. And you are a member of that training cadre of instructors and have been there for, you know, 20 plus years. And so every single agent that has been an OIG agent for, you know, the mid-90s forward was educated and trained in some way, shape, or form on the Medicare program by you, on everything from Part A to Part B. And I don't think that people really fully understand the breadth and depth of that. You know, that's a very important piece of the puzzle, right? Because people don't know what Medicare is when they get hired in some cases. They don't understand what the programs are. They don't understand what the schemes are. And so it's an important piece of the puzzle because you have touched every single OIG agent's career without maybe you really thinking about that or others thinking about it. But we in New York, particularly Jason and I, were spoiled because you worked out of the New York region and were just a few floors from us and probably spent as much time in our office as you did your own office. So I want to switch gears a little bit and just have you talk a little bit about how you really were the gap bridger. You know, typically CMS, you know, my mentor, Jason, he's got a lot of Eisengrinisms, and one of his Eisengrinisms would always be that the biggest fight you will ever have in your career will always be with CMS with respect to a policy or a rule or something along those lines, because CMS wants to give the money away and the OIG wants to keep the money. And you always seem to be that person that was in the office to kind of be that gap bridger to help with facilitating those kinds of conversations. So I just want to spend a few minutes where, you know, maybe you can talk a little bit about how you saw your role with, at the time, it was at some point, it was known as the Program Integrity Group, but it quickly changed its name to CPI because the Program Integrity Group's acronym was not very pleasant, but the CPI, Center for Program Integrity, was a little bit more pleasant. I think I'd rather be known as CPI than the PIG, and I get that, but let's talk a little bit about how you saw your role in bridging the gap between the law enforcement community, particularly the OIG, and CMS.
I was really lucky because I was invited to teach at FLETC in Georgia and do Medicare 101 and then Medicare Fraud and Abuse. I also was an instructor for FBI at Quantico. So I did a lot of most of the basic same training for a lot of FBI agents too. So you get to know, you get to know what the issues are on both sides of the house, you know, and educating, not just, you got to start with the basics of what the program is, because you might have people who've been doing, you know, paying child support and defaulting on those that used to go after a lot. Healthcare fraud's got everybody's attention because that's where the money is. So I had so much fun. I worked with our central office a lot. I did a stint in Baltimore for 6 months, running Part B medical review for a while. So I interacted with a lot of the central office people and the agencies there and the divisions. And then I was really lucky because in New York, we partnered with OIG and in Operation Restore Trust, where we set up specific target areas like nursing homes. And we worked with OIG, you know, CMS, it was picked for the time, but, you know, CMS and all of the agencies involved, plus our program, we were, you know, MACS at the time, getting them involved in identifying, and we actually went out and picked samples of patients, looking on site at their medical records, walking through the facilities. So, you know, like nursing home was one of the main ones. And we'd go out with our survey and certification staff at CMS, who were in the facilities looking at, you know, do they have meeting the fire safety codes? Do they have evacuation plans in place? And we're like, yeah, but what else is going on? You know, are there patients that are being sort of warehoused? You know, are they getting, and you're just looking at sort of the healthcare issues, you know, if they're getting pressure sores. So there's a quality of care issue that they can deal with. The other is who's coming in to see them? Who's cruising the floors? You go in and you start looking at who's on the sign-in sheet. Well, who are they? And it's like one thing if you're going to see four patients on a floor. If these people are going to see every single patient on a floor, that's a red flag. And I remember being in one of the facilities, where I walk in and everybody is sitting in a chair outside their room with their feet in a bucket, waiting for the podiatrist to come in. And, you know, the podiatrist is sitting out in his car in the parking lot, you know, listening to music, cruising, and his people are all in, you know, doing basic toenail care, you know, in Medicare.
Of course they are.
Yeah, we didn't do mani-pedi under Medicare. You had to have a medical condition. You know, obviously, if the patient, you know, can't reach their toes because they're physically unable, that's one thing. If they've got, you know, it's funny how everybody had mycotic nails because that was a treatable condition. You just start to see, you didn't even have to do data analysis. You just open your eyes when you walk through. So when you're educating the people who are going in, like that, you see kind of that, you know, ask about it. Call me, let me call the desk. You know, it's just like, and when we had Medicare contractors, you could call the contractor to say, I think you need to do something. Call the regional office, get a surveyor from the state agency, because we had the feds that go in checking on the state people. You know, there were all of these interconnecting dots. If you knew what to look for, you know, you look for striped polka dots, you know, it's like fabric, you know, it's like, I always work fashion into this somehow, but it's like you're going to see, you know, the dots are the people, the stripe, you know, the victims, the stripes are the criminals. So I'm wearing my crim top today. That's why we always put them in jail and they're in prison stripes. You know, there's a reason for all of this.
It's interesting because you really were kind of this person that was able to bridge the gap in certain ways because you understood where CMS was coming from on its things. You understood where OIG was coming from on its things. And then really, you know, you've testified around the country more times than you can probably keep track of and still continue to be called upon by Department of Justice on a variety of cases. And so, you know, it's a great career that you had because you were really one of those people who were kind of in a position to understand both sides of a coin that either side didn't really want to care to listen to, right? And that's really an important piece of it. So I want to fast forward a little bit because you retired a few years ago and we touched upon it a few minutes ago, but you are now very, very intrinsically involved with something that is known as the Senior Medicare Patrol. And as everything in government, there must be an acronym, and that is the SMP. And you are currently sitting in the New York SMP office where you are a fixture there. And even in retirement, you have continued to fight the fight and protect seniors and protect the Medicare Trust Fund. Tell us a little bit, and then I'm going to turn it over to Wade, but for just a minute or two, talk a little bit about what is the Senior Medicare Patrol. How does it work? How is it funded? And what does it do?
Glad you asked. And I'm going to make a pitch to come back and do the SMP slides that we give to our seniors so that your people in the field, in the contractors, are going to know when they get the complaints, what's prompting them. And then also give us feedback how to update the slides, because you know, we've got seniors out there. Senior Medicare Patrol is in all 50 states and the territories. It's funded by CMS and the Administration for Community Living is the entity that oversees the contracts in each of the states. They're now, for a shorter period of time, a five-year contract so that when an entity becomes a grantee or contractor, they have time to hire people and train them. And then you've got this working cadre. In the past, when it was a much shorter time frame, you'd have everybody up and running, and then you'd be in the competition for the next season, or the next round. And if you did not get the contract, your entity, all of that training went away, and a new entity has the contract, and they're starting training people. And so you're losing all that institutional knowledge. So having a five-year time frame is a much better context in which to operate. And then because you're not only training these volunteers, you're going out and getting them to volunteer for your specific entity, your contract. You're then also partnering with all of, you know, the Medicare contractors, Office of Inspector General, all of the state agencies, the MFUCU, the state Medicaid agency, because a lot of seniors are dual eligible. They're eligible for Medicare because of their age or disability and Medicaid because of their income. And so it's pulling all of the actors together and then doing training and going out and training the seniors themselves. Before that, you train the volunteers in SMP. And then we're also training state agency staff at times, some of our Medicare contractors, and then also sitting in on any of the task forces and reaching out to all of the entities that are interacting with seniors, the people that do the Meals on Wheels, the senior centers, the community centers. And then as volunteers with SMP, we're also going out and educating. We're doing in-person now a little more, it's beefing up, but we had to go into that Zoom phase. But before COVID, I was out, you know, two or three times a week at a community center in Brooklyn or the Bronx or Staten Island, doing outreach and education. To just tell seniors what Medicare and Medicaid are, warning them about their cards, and the scammers and, you know, telemarketing, which took off incredibly during COVID. So, you know, I stay busy, but I also get an ear to the ground because you're hearing what's changing. You know, as right. I said, you know, seniors are now getting, in New York anyway, we're getting complaints about people marketing expired COVID tests. And that come then with a fake FDA label.
So yeah.
The fun
so continues. I want to turn it over to you because when you were out in LA, particularly when you were an assistant special agent in charge, you interacted with the SMP. So I want to turn it over to you to talk to Gene a little bit about that interaction and sort of, you know, see where your thoughts are on this.
Yeah, I met with SMP, you know, volunteers and I guess members probably on a quarterly or at least biannually basis. And it was really interesting because it really was, as Gene was kind of alluding to, it's really a two-way street when we meet. I would get intel from what their members and volunteers were seeing on the street. I would also be able to tell them kind of what we were seeing as far as our agents out on the street. And they were really the probably the most attentive audience. Wherever I would speak, they were all, you know, very interested in what we had to say. They were taking notes. They had great follow-up questions, probably more so than any other kind of professional audience that we would speak to. But it really was, you know, we would be able to tell them what the agents were seeing on the street, whether it would be, you know, the capping activity where people were approaching seniors and offering them, you know, anything from cash or just a lunch in order to, you know, get their Medicare card. And we would hear the same thing from them where it's like, oh, we're hearing that this one you know, senior center has these people coming in and they're taking people out to lunch, and then they're finding out later that all this medical equipment was ordered for them, DME equipment, and they, you know, they're, the story is that it's free, and between us and the SMP volunteers, we're trying to explain to them that it's really not free, that Medicare is paying for it. So there was really just a partnership. And I mean, we learned a lot from them, and I think they learned from us. And again, it was one of probably one of the better sources that we had. And I know that we met with them a lot in Los Angeles, in Orange County, and in Honolulu as well. And I'm just curious, Gene, if that was really the case across the country. I would hope that it was, because it's really a resource that if our OIG offices weren't meeting with them, they were kind of missing out. But I'm just curious if that was across the country, if it was like that, or it was just a few pockets where we had that relationship.
The feedback I'm hearing has always been very positive. LA is one of the ones that also has a CMS field office that really focuses on fraud and abuse. So does Brooklyn. You know, there were originally the five hotspots, and those numbers have increased. So SMP in those areas is very, and the regional offices, if you're in one of the 10 CMS regional office cities, you know, there's much more opportunity to interact with federal agencies, not just CMS, but OIG. A lot of them are co-located, or they're sponsoring, you know, monthly or quarterly fraud and abuse task force meetings or working groups and things. And I think now that we're doing a lot more things virtually, I think that SMP is linking in even more areas where they can get the seniors, if they're not at the center, who are the volunteers or the seniors, to educate them, but they also then participate in the bigger meetings to get the bigger picture. So it's getting better and better. And I think that the Administration on Community Living is focusing much more on coordinating within HHS, not just CMS and OIG, but other agencies as well. And I think then they're also reaching out to the states because of the Medicaid link. But LA was extremely active, doing a lot of education, not just for, you know, interacting with seniors, but also with our Medicare contractors and CMS staff themselves, and Survey and Cert. You know, they were involved in all the special studies. They would go off and do a lot of stuff on their own, finding loopholes, coming up with recommendations on how to fix them. And Brent Pearson, who's the head of the LA field office located in Orange County, has testified in a number of trials. And they're all aware of where the touch points are. And, you know, it's they have their ear to the ground. They're hearing the same kinds of things that you do. And just exchanging the information with our contractors and with law enforcement is critical.
So let's stay on the West Coast. Since we've moved to the West Coast, let's stay there. So Jason was, for a number of years, most recently, he was the UPIC West director. And for those that don't know all the vernacular, the UPIC is the Unified Program Integrity Contractor. There are five of those, plus what's known as the MEDIC. And they are essentially the Special Investigative Unit, or SIU, for Medicare. Jason ran the UPIC West, which included about 13 or 14 states, I believe, but obviously California was one of them. So, and I know, Jason, when we were first getting ready to get on here with Gene, you talked a little about the SMP and the interaction with the UPIC. So I'm going to turn it over to you for a minute here.
Thank you. First, I want to beg everyone's indulgence because I want to thank Gene publicly for being my mentor and kindling my interest in Medicare and Medicaid program integrity. My HHS career took a turn in the 80s where I became a program integrity specialist for Medicaid in the New York office for then HCFA. And without Gene, I doubt very much that, you know, my personal career would have stayed on the track that it in fact did. So thank you, Gene, for that. Regarding the SMP, and particularly in California, it was essential in identifying the vulnerabilities of hospice. So, you know, about half of the hospices in the United States are in California, and most of those are in Southern California. So just it reminds me, and Gene and Eric will definitely both relate to this, were DME companies in Brighton Beach in the 1990s. And, you know, it just, if and to your point, Gene, if you didn't know that data analytics is the wave of the future back then, you didn't need anything other than a list, because it was just so clear that it didn't need to be four DME companies on a single block in Brooklyn. So, you know, similarly, this vulnerability in hospice became rampant. And at least my perception is that the SMP was a major player in bringing this to the attention of law enforcement and to contractors such as the UPIC, in targeting hospices that were truly abusing the benefit. So for instance, you know, beneficiary solicitation became very much the key modality to generating, you know, many millions of dollars of false and fraudulent billing. So my question, sorry for that lengthy introduction, but my question is twofold. One, I guess it's by way of context that I've been hearing from political consultants and cohorts that I have interacted with for many years that the current administration doesn't look at program integrity in Medicare and Medicaid the way that past administrations have. They look at it as it possibly is inhibiting those that are in need or deserving of those services, that it's somehow you know, adversely impacting them receiving those services. Whereas the tenet of program integrity, again, from my perception over the years, has been that, you know, it's all about saving the resources, the limited resources that there are, for those that are truly in need. So the second part of it is, you know, if you agree, or even if you don't agree with that premise, do you think that the SMP, or if you have other ways that entities and individuals could interact with the administration to kind of get back on track, that program integrity is a way to increase the opportunities for those that are in need of services and getting them, and not decrease them?
I think that one of the major issues in limited interaction has been COVID itself, because the people focusing on healthcare and rendering healthcare, the big focus on all of the federal government is getting the funds out to emergency hospitals, critical care entities, emergency rooms. And now that we're in the tridemic here in New York and a lot of major cities with, you know, the flu and RSD and COVID, I think resources, the big focus was just dealing with the forest fire, you know, and not planting more trees. And I think that has been part of it. The fact that regional offices closed, central offices closed, people weren't working from home remotely, contractors were working from home remotely, surveyors were not out in the facilities because the facilities were locked down. If you're trying to get into a hospice, you family members couldn't even get in, let alone surveyors. And the big focus was diverted into a lot of other, we were like in crisis mode. We were coming out of it, but going back into it on certain levels. I think that obviously the budget is on everybody's mind, Congress, you know, the voting public, and the dollar amounts for Medicare and Medicaid can't be ignored. And I think that, you know, the administrative budgets to support them, I think right now are at risk of being cut. So the word needs to get out. And I think grassroots organizations like Senior Medicare Patrol, who at our convention had, you know, CMS and the state agencies, the governor's office in New York, trying to get their attention to show them what the needs are, what the, you know, the hot spots are, and concrete ways of addressing them. It's one thing to, you know, wave your arms and say, we've got this problem, we've got this problem, you know, healthcare fraud's through the roof. What are we going to do about it? Where do we need to focus our resources? And the Medicare contractors are where it starts, because they're the ones getting the claims. The people who are licensure and certification, letting the providers into the program, need to be educated. You know, there was a really good article in the December 5th New Yorker about hospice fraud. And it really, you know, there's one of the things they said was, you know, California and the way in which they had more than like 4,000 for-profit hospices. And, you know, in New York, we have very, you know, on a scale like 1/10 of that maybe. And it started with a state licensure and how difficult it is, or what kind of review goes on at the state level to even get a license to operate. So it's like, there's federal issues, there's state issues, but it's somebody who's got to be pointing to say, this needs to be addressed, this needs to be addressed, and articulate it in a way that it can be prioritized to the people who are making the decisions. So I'm now in the grassroots level as opposed to the recommending regulations and statutes and fee, coding. But, you know, I wish I had a really good solution. I'm terrified that things are at risk right now. And I think that the more that we can do to educate our legislators and our assembly people, obviously the states that are involved, and get the word up the line. And Senior Medicare Patrol does its best to get those kinds of words out in both directions, upward to, you know, the state and the feds, and then downward to the counties and community centers and the seniors. And our Medicare contractors the same way, because they're interacting with the physicians and the doctors and the hospitals and the hospices that are billing, and they're interacting with the individuals whose claims are coming through that are being reviewed. Data analysis is the key. You know, where are the hotspots? You know, and it's complaints from a beneficiary that tip off people to look a little closer sometimes. And other times there are things going on in the data and there's an anomaly and it's like, what is causing this? And it's looking deeper, but then when you're looking deeper, knowing what that means. And it's just getting an educated contractor staff and oversight staff and, you know, all parts. It's scary times that we live in right now. And, you know, I'm looking at, you know, inflation is up, cost of living is up, you know, they're going to, you know, the Fed is going to raise interest rates again. You know, there's all kinds of things competing for our attention. And back when you had limited information, you got, you know, right now you can go online and find out all kinds of things that'll keep you up at night. You know, before there used to be limited things that would keep you up. Now all of these other areas, and life just kind of got really complicated. And there are people out there who make their living on having life being complicated, you know, whether they're selling cryptocurrency or healthcare. You know, there's money to be made. And there is a kind of a change in the provider community, and for-profits are taking over, so that you've got hedge funds backing companies that are buying up hospitals and nursing homes and hospices, and their focus is profit. And I get it, you know, even if you're a not-for-profit hospital, you've got to be able to pay your bills and turn a profit. But paying shareholders is, at the price of providing care to a dying patient is something that somebody needs to take a look at.
So we've got just a few minutes left, and the last few minutes I want to spend. So you brought up something, Gene, and just sort of, you know, we don't script this. We just kind of free speak. And, you know, Gene, you brought up something which is pretty important, which is the SMP is a grassroots effort, meaning from the bottom. It starts with the beneficiaries. And so that actually parlays into Matt. And I know, Matt, you know, you and I talked a little bit earlier about the SMP and how it can help on the UPIC side from the investigations perspective. So I want to turn it over to you, because that piece of the puzzle really is probably one of the most important pieces, because obviously in any investigation, it's getting to the beneficiary who has the information and getting them to share that information with the appropriate people. And really the SMP works really hard to be able to facilitate those kind of communications. So Matt, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Sure. Thanks. Before I get into that, I just wanted to reemphasize one point that Gene talked about early on, which was Operation Restore Trust. That the impact of that effort cannot be minimized. It was groundbreaking in terms of getting so many agencies together that had been siloed before that, who, as you know, Eric, you talked about, you know, CMS and OIG being at odds. The premise or the presuppositions these agencies went to the table with were that they were not going to get along, that, you know, I wanted X, they don't want us to do X. You know, the OIG wants to put the bad guys away. CMS doesn't want that because it's going to hurt access to care and all of these things. Sitting down at the table and talking about the balance that had to be made to make that project work, to bring a true sense of program integrity throughout all of those agencies in line with what the all of the priorities of all of those agencies were, was an incredible piece of work. I mean, my boss at the time, Jim Kopf, and I worked endlessly as the liaison to CMS on that project. And it went all the way from, you know, DOJ, FBI, the Administration on Aging, you know, to going down to the grassroots area, getting the word out to the beneficiaries. Hey, we are here. If something you believe is not right is going on, please tell us. That was very controversial back then. I mean, it was getting in the way between the patient-doctor relationship. You know, you want the patient to tell on their doctor. You know, all of those efforts were groundbreaking, and it's the model for how program integrity is working now in terms of, you know, the MCC at CMS bringing all the parties together, the task forces that DOJ has set up in all of those areas, bringing all of the parties to the table at the same time. That was the first time. And Gene was a prime element of that. Now, in terms of the SMP, when I was the director of the Northeast, you know, we dedicated multiple bodies to go and work with the SMPs in each of the states. We did outreach and education with the volunteers. Gene and I spoke together in Brooklyn at one point to the SMP volunteers there. And the importance of that, you know, is incredible. And you know, our investigators, you know, need to work better with the SMPs, because what we found, the SMP is very effective. You know, they tell the beneficiaries, you know, if somebody calls you and they want your information, don't give it. And they're absolutely right. You know, when we were doing beneficiary interviews, which are a huge part of any investigation, you know, I was sitting in a beneficiary's house, his phone rang 10 times. And every time it was either a genetic testing lab or a DME company wanting his information. And so they're right in doing that. But what happens is with the UPIC, especially during COVID, when everything was telephonic, the UPIC investigators would be calling the beneficiaries to get their information about the services that they may or may not have received. And the beneficiaries were saying, I'm not going to give that to you. And they would hang up. So there has to be a better coordination between the UPICs and the SMPs so that everybody is on the same page in terms of, hey, we're all working this together.
Duly noted. I'm taking notes here. Taking names.
Well, and from the UPIC's perspective, you know, they've got to reach out more to the SMP volunteers to go out and jointly do more of that training so that the beneficiaries know it.
Perfect.
You know, I think for some of this, and we're kind of, you know, running to the top of the time here, but, you know, for some of the agents that are out there, I'm hoping that OIG agents are tuning in and listening to, you know, four old guys pontificate about the good old days. But, you know, there are some things that come about as, you know, the takeaways, and the SMP really is an important piece of that role. You know, the SMP played a very pivotal role on a case in New Jersey that I worked. I worked the very first genetic testing fraud case in the country in 2015. It involved a guy who was running a sham not-for-profit. He was going into senior citizen buildings touting his not-for-profit, but he was really a sales rep for the genetic testing companies and using fear-mongering and fear tactics of you need to get this test or you will die from an adverse reaction, you know, scaring people into taking that test. The S&P for New Jersey was the facilitator for that referral. At the time, Jean was still at CMS. She was kind of liaisoning with them and was an integral part in being able to put me as an OIG agent with the New Jersey S&P to be able to really get to the heart of the matter. And so I think that, you know, one piece of advice from an old OIG guy to agents who might be listening to this is the S&P is an unbelievably valuable source of information. The amount of intelligence that they get on a daily basis is as good as you can get from any other intelligence that you're gathering, because the people that are volunteering are oftentimes seniors themselves who understand where this is all coming from, but they're hearing this stuff, you know, on day to day. So if you don't know anything about the Senior Medicare Patrol, go onto your favorite search engine, look it up. If you're not interested in volunteering, they have newsletters, they have stuff on their website. It's absolutely worth going and doing that. Jean, we're certainly going to have you back on so you can run through that slide deck. I think it's an important piece. We have thousands of people that tune into these. Our YouTube channel has it. It's an important piece of that. You know, I think my closing statements are going to be that, you know, you have touched everyone who is in the healthcare fraud, waste, and abuse world. You have touched every single person that's been doing this for 25 years or more. And so it makes no sense for people to not continue to want to tap in to the resources that are provided through organizations that you currently participate in. I encourage people to go and read the article. Jean is quoted in that article. It's in New Yorker Magazine. It's from ProPublica. And it is a great article to read. You know, read it with a grain of salt. It's not perfect. It tells a story, and it's an important thing that people need to understand. Jean was quoted in that article. Jean is quoted in a number of articles. But I will also recommend that if you're on Instagram, you look for Jean Stone on Instagram as part of her idiosyncratic fashionistas website. Her and her partner in crime, Valerie, are well-known in the New York scene when it comes to fashion, Fashion Week, Bryant Park, all of that. If you're in New York, I recommend you look Jean up. She knows all of the fabulous places to go and hang out, because it's not all about living to work, it's working to live. And even in retirement, Jean has found unbelievable ways to work to live. I look forward to having you on again in January to talk about the S&P, your slide deck more, and talk more about that. Jason, I'm going to give you the final word before I actually turn it over to Jean for her final word. But any parting thoughts from you, Grand Poobah?
Well, Eric, you took my point, and I'll just reiterate it because it really is important. And what we do is about developing sources of information. So whether it's Jean as an individual, whether it's the S&P as an organization, and really most importantly, the Medicare and Medicaid beneficiaries, and I'm sure for commercial insurers, the members, if you will, those resources are essential to putting together your investigation. So if you discount any of those, you'd be doing yourself a major disservice. Thank you.
And Jean, any final thoughts for you before we wrap up for the day?
Well, I think that Jason touched on it too, that the private insurers, if they're ripping off Medicare and Medicaid, they're ripping off the private insurers in the same way. And so they're having losses, the same providers. If you throw them out of our programs, they might end up still, you know, if they're not allowed to bill or they're on prepay review, they're just going to beef up all of their work in the private sector. And I think that the coordination between private insurers, the private insurer organizations, you know, with the Medicare and Medicaid, law enforcement and contractors and beneficiaries, the same thing, you know, AARP, you know, it starts at 50. A lot of those people are not in Medicare, but they're in health insurance and they're seeing the scams. And we're still in open season for commercial Medicare Advantage plan closed. The deadline was the 7th of December, but the private managed care organizations are still up and operating, and they're getting people to enroll to be effective January 1st. So the same fraudsters are out there, the same kinds of ways of getting somebody to provide their health insurance and, you know, billing information and enrolling. You know, people end up asking for information and they find they're enrolled in a private plan that they never planned to be in. The same schemes just work across. So the more we talk, the more we learn.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a phrase that I love to use, which is that the circus stays the same. It's the clowns that change, right? Because it's always this recapitulation. So thank you so much, everybody, for participating. Thank you to our viewers who tune in and listen to us pontificate. As always, thanks to my professional and personal coworkers and friends, Wade, Matt, and Jason. And thank you, Gene, as always. It is always great to see and speak to you about these topics. For those of you that do not get our newsletter, I do encourage you to ask to get a copy of it. Our recordings are always attached to that newsletter. You can send us an email at hello@advisehealth, A-D-V-I-Z-E, health, H-E-A-L-T-H, oneword.com. You can get onto our newsletter. You can always find us on our YouTube channel. Just go to YouTube and look for Advise Health, where all of our recordings are found. And again, I want to thank everybody. Have a great holiday season. Have a great, happy, and healthy new year. And we'll see you in January. Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Thank you.